On this week's 51%, hear from a woman dating afar.
There's so much things that we can gain just by deciding to listen. Not to words, but to the way people say things.
Immigrant women find support in a certain group, and moving can mean a career issue for military spouses. I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%. You grew up before the cell phone era, or BCE, as some of our younger listeners might think of it. You'll remember what it was like to actually have to wait in one place for someone to call. This could be really frustrating, even more so when it came to the dating world. You could wait around endlessly for the phone to ring, and it might not. In some ways, it seems like we're talking about the dark ages, but you might also think of it as a lost Eden. I mean, today, with all the countless dating apps, Tinder, Bumble, JSwipe, the list goes on. People are in this frantic holding pattern all the time. Every ping, each vibration could be a message from the one. It's exhausting. And the next story is about dating in the smartphone age. Actually, it's about a lot more. Judah Kaufman tells us how one woman from Tel Aviv had to decide between listening to her instincts or trusting an algorithm.
Our story starts with the classic millennial quarter-life crisis.
It was after I quit my job. I felt like I needed something to look forward to.
That's Sharon Torton. She's 24, lives in Tel Aviv.
I study philosophy. I used to be an LGBT activist. I still kind of see myself as an activist, but just postponing it for a little bit.
That postponing took the form of a big backpacking trip across the Balkans.
To Slovenia, Croatia, Macedonia, and Bulgaria.
So Sharon set off. She was seeing new places, clearing her head. Everything was going according to plan. That is, until she got to Macedonia. There, she did what a lot of young people do to get a more intimate knowledge of a new place. She opened up Tinder.
Not for anything, like, yeah, sexual is nice, but that's not the thing. The thing is, I wanted to find someone local that I can speak to about the experience of living in this place that I am.
Sharon swiped and swiped.
To be honest, well, like 70% of the people I see on Tinder, I swipe left.
Left swiping on Tinder means you don't want to talk to that person. And things progressed as usual for Sharon. Left, 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 until...
Wow, she's gorgeous. One of the most beautiful women I've ever seen. She has like large brown eyes and her skin is like flawless. I swiped right. And then we had a match, surprisingly.
Sharon and her match, Kansu, started messaging. They covered all the small talky questions you'd expect. Sharon said she was traveling from Israel. Kansu said she was a student from Turkey.
She was super nice, like overly nice.
And they ended up making a plan for Kansu to join Sharon and some of her friends at a pub the next night.
It was like a traditional Eastern European restaurant. Wooden walls and everything was really cozy, and we sat by the fireplace, so it was even more cozy.
Sharon and her friends arrived a bit early. They were drinking, hanging out, and then the door opened.
And when she came in, I looked at her, and she looked at me, but she kind of also looked away. I think she was really shy.
But, like lots of people discover, after sitting in a pub for long enough, initial shyness can melt away. Soon, Sharon and Kansu were laughing, passing phones back and forth, and scrolling through travel pictures. The evening progressed. Their group eventually left the bar, everyone went bowling, there was even a stolen smooch in the corner of the alley. By 10, most of the group had peeled off, and Sharon found herself at Kansu's kitchen table, sipping from a freshly brewed cup of coffee.
Turkish coffee, which is the best.
It was a bittersweet moment. At the stroke of midnight, the glass slippers would disappear, and Sharon's overnight bus to Bulgaria would pull out of the station. A proverbial pumpkin carriage, if there ever was one.
And then she told me, don't go. And I was like, how can I not go? I mean, I told my friends in Sofia that I'm coming, and I already bought the bus tickets. It's not possible not to go. But then she said again, don't go. And every time she said don't go, I was like, I don't want to go. I know I don't want to go.
So Sharon made a deal with herself. She'd stay the night, but be on the first bus out the next morning. 7 a.m. sharp.
Did you leave at 7?
Of course not.
Sharon stayed for a day and a night. A one-night stand became a two-night stand. And at this point, I want to say the 2 days turned into a week and then another. To tell you about their old t-shirts and books and hair elastics mixing together. The bric-a-brac of two separate lives swirling into one. But it didn't happen like that. There was still this one obstacle in their way.
We couldn't really speak because we had no common language whatsoever.
See, Sharon speaks Hebrew and English, Kansu, Turkish, and Macedonian. And all of their communications had been mediated by the slow passing back and forth of a smartphone open to Google Translate. Sharon remembers the first time she tried it.
I wrote, "You look really beautiful." And I wrote it in English and I translated it to Turkish. And then I showed her the phone and she had the shyest smile I've ever seen. But I saw that she was really happy.
That might seem like shaky ground to build a connection on, but Sharon doesn't think so.
There is so much things that we can gain just by deciding to listen. Not to words, but to the way people say things or the way they look at us. So from some perspectives, you can say we're not as close. From other perspective, you can say we're closer because we must listen.
For two magical days, Sharon and Kansu told each other everything and said nothing. They knew that soon enough, they'd have to go back to real life and find a way to Google Translate goodbye.
When I left eventually to go to Sofia, I wrote her this letter and I wrote that leaving her bed this morning was one of the hardest things I've had to do. I didn't think we were gonna last. I mean, it was too crazy. But when I came to Israel, she started asking me, okay, so when are you coming back to Macedonia? And I was like, oh, well, good question.
The answer? A whole 3 weeks later.
I came back to Macedonia and we were there for a month.
And like a lot of relationships, as the butterflies quieted and the connection deepened, it also got more complicated.
The whole month we were not only in Macedonia, we also went to Turkey to meet her family.
Kansu had grown up in a religious Muslim family in a small Turkish village. Being gay and out wasn't a viable option. So when she and Sharon visited,
we had this cover story.
They said Sharon was also a student in Macedonia, that they were neighbors and had decided to travel together. But for Sharon, a Tel Avivi LGBT activist, keeping up this story, going back into the closet like that, was no easy task. And the trip brought up some of her own baggage as well.
Everyone told me, what the are you doing? This is crazy. It's Turkey, it's a Muslim country. And not only that it's a Muslim country that you're going to, not like Istanbul or a place where it's easy to find you, but this like tiny village in the edge of Turkey, it can go really badly. And she told me, I'll never forget this, she told me, you know, if you believe them, then you believe what they're saying about me. And when she told me this, I was like, oh, because it's true. Because if all Muslims are like this, then it's also about her and about her family, about her friends. It was really hard.
Even with everything in their way, different religions, enemy countries, language barriers, really, Sharon and Kansu are just working through the exact same questions as every other couple on Earth. How can we communicate better? How can we know each other more deeply? And they're committed to finding an answer, together.
I am willing to go wherever she goes. And we have a lot of dreams, because I think this whole experience has made us both believe that we can do whatever we want.
And in those dreams, are you talking the same language?
In these dreams, we have our own language that only us understand.
In fact, those dreams are becoming a reality. The morning after Sharon and I spoke, she boarded a plane. She had a suitcase, a one-way ticket to Macedonia, and no plans on coming back. From the outside, Sharon and Kansu's story can seem like one of distances and gaps. At its center, though, there's a single relationship. And beyond that, sets of families and friends and countries pushed apart by historical accidents and follies, now drawn closer, all because of a love knitted together by translation algorithms, coded across rolling continents and frothy oceans in Californian suburbs, half a world away. And in those suburbs, servers that shoot back the translated love notes up and up through the clouds and the gases and the black to the blinking satellites in the starry beyond. And all that, that's not a story of distances. That's a story of coming together.
And it's a story that was brought to us from Judah Kaufman, from Israel's Story. Sure, it's a love story, but it's a story with a broader message amid all of today's clamor. Grupo de Mujeres, or Women's Group, is there for the dignity of the women and their families. It's at the Workers' Defense Project. You're about to hear a few of the women's stories, produced by John Pointer for Stories from Deep in the Heart, a project of Texas Folklife for the Story Summer Institute series, Immigration and Labor, Stories from the Texas Workforce.
We're examples to our children. This is why we must be informed, because information is like a weapon for me.
That was Brenda, a member of Grupo de Mujeres, women acting as advocates for the Workers' Defense Project, or Proyecto Defensa Laboral, in Austin, Texas. Community plays a strong role for workers, families, and immigrant families supporting themselves in the Texas workforce, especially in the face of frightening challenges. That is exactly what brought Brenda to the Workers' Defense Project.
I'm here because something sad occurred in my family. Immigration arrested part of my family. I was left alone. I was left desperate. I didn't know what to do. I knocked on PDL's door, and thank God they helped me so much.
The women of Grupo de Mujeres helped their members transcend isolation in many ways. Such was the case with Liz.
I came here for English classes. It was an awesome find. I discovered all of the benefits this organization offers me as a woman, as an immigrant, and as a construction worker. I've been working for a year on immigration and part of the groups that focus on construction. Laws that protect construction workers, immigrant persons, and I'm very happy to be here. If a woman looks for a job in construction, they will only give her a cleaning position. Here, this is for you because you're a woman. So I'm wanting and fighting for women to be respected and for space to be carved for us to have other roles, not just cleaning.
The community is especially meaningful to Desenia, who has no family in Austin, where she is self-employed as a domestic worker.
Well, I make a decision to be a leader. I'm brand new, so I don't know exactly what they're doing, but I'm learning more, and I start coming to the immigration group because I would like to learn my rights, and then I can pass to another guys and invite them to come over, and then they know their rights too.
We end with Sylvia, a 9-year member at Workers' Defense Project. She's held leadership roles there while entrenching herself in issues like SB4 and paid sick leave. Her husband's a construction worker.
This is only for women, but we're working with the other groups to encourage and helping and learning about how to defend ourselves. We have meetings twice a month, and a certain group, we are like more than 10 ladies, organize and help each other. And learning and participating in the organization in different actions and different ways.
Stepping up to a role as an advocate, in addition to raising a family, working a full-time job, or simply trying to secure a better life for yourself on your own can feel exhausting. Grupo de Mujeres provides support and community and empowers women to become stronger together.
No tengan miedo, no tengan pena. Involúcrense con la comunidad.
Háganse conocer y alcen la voz.
Don't be scared. Don't be shy. Get involved with your community. Let yourself be known and speak up. I invite more women to become part of our group because here you may find the help that sometimes you may not find where you currently are. We're a family that's here to help you, and you're not alone. Please knock on our door. We'll be here waiting.
This story was produced by John Pointer with assistance from Chase Frank for Stories from Deep in the Heart, a project of Texas Folklife.
Military families move a lot, which can make it hard for service members' spouses to maintain steady careers. It's especially difficult in careers like healthcare that require professional licenses, because those licenses rarely transfer from state to state. Sarah Harris reports.
Alita Nims is spending her summer shuttling her two sons from one day camp to another.
Oh, you know what? I have to run in and grab his lunch. Hold on a second. I missed that yesterday.
Nims and her family moved to upstate New York from Tacoma, Washington a year ago for her husband's military job. He's the Air Force Detachment Commander at Clarkson University, where he teaches ROTC students. Nims was in the Air Force, too, but she went back to school to become a mental health counselor and spent years building up a private practice.
I had probably between 25 to 30 clients that I was working with.
But moving to New York meant leaving her practice behind. There are two professional exams you can take if you want to be a mental health counselor. New York accepts one, Washington accepts another. If Nims wanted to keep working in her field, she'd have to get re-licensed.
We pulled into town on July 30th. On August 1st, we went and started house hunting and looked at like 10 houses in one day. And on August 2nd, I started freaking out that I was losing my career. And I was like, what am I doing? This is insane. I worked so hard to get my license in Washington, and I can't not be licensed.
So she started the licensing process all over again.
Of course, it's all online, and, you know, you're not talking to anybody, so you're kind of trying to read the instructions, and I had to fumble through some of that and understand the paperwork that I needed.
Nims had to dig up tons of documents, which took months. She had to get approved by the state to take the exam, wait a month for a testing date, and pay a bunch of fees. Although, because she's a military spouse, New York will refund her some of that money. She says she gets why the regulations are in place. There are bad actors out there.
But, you know, for the rest of us who are, you know, just honest people trying to do good things in the world, it can become a very, very frustrating and complicated process to try to work through.
There's no guarantee of a job for Alita Nims at the end of this. Her husband's assignment in New York is only 3 years long. Like a lot of military spouses, she found herself asking whether pursuing licensing was actually worth it. Because the next time they move,
I could be in this exact same position again.
If it takes you 2 years to kind of get through the system, it isn't a very effective system.
That's Lynn Borden, head of the Department of Family Social Science at the University of Minnesota. Borden and her colleagues worked with the DOD to study state licensing accommodations for military spouses. They found 48 states have tried to make the process easier by lowering fees for military spouses or fast-tracking their applications. But because states maintain their own licensing requirements, the process can still be baffling.
To find that information and then to figure out who to talk to often became very hard.
That's the sort of thing that can discourage spouses from getting their professional licenses. And that, University of Minnesota research scientist Adia Richmond says, has a ripple effect
on their family's financial health and their satisfaction. And we know ultimately can impact how long the service member chooses to stay in service.
Richmond says one of the biggest things state occupational boards can do to make the process easier for military spouses is to post clear guidelines on their websites and make sure there's an actual human spouses can get in touch with. This last year, Alita Nims has made it work. They get by on her husband's salary. She started selling skincare products to bring in extra money. And there's been a bright side. She's been able to spend more time with her kids.
For me to have that kind of extra just time and mental bandwidth to be able to devote to parenting, I think has been a huge blessing.
And Nims may end up working in her field after all. She just took the licensing exam to become a mental health counselor in New York State, and she passed. Now she's waiting to finally get her hands on her license so she can go find a job. I'm Sarah Harris.
This story was produced by the American Homefront Project, a public media collaboration that reports on American military life and veterans. A large study of first-time moms finds that they are less likely to need a cesarean delivery if labor is induced at 39 weeks rather than waiting for it to start on its own. The results overturn the long-time view that inducing labor raises the risk for a C-section. Two leading OBGYN doctor groups say it's now reasonable to offer that option to women at low risk of birth complications. Study participants who were induced were less likely to develop dangerous high blood pressure at the end of pregnancy and reported less pain and a greater sense of control. Babies had fewer respiratory problems and spent less time in the hospital. Results were published by the New England Journal of Medicine. A Tokyo medical school has apologized after an internal investigation confirmed that it systematically altered entrance exam scores for years to limit the number of female students and ensure more men became doctors. Tokyo Medical University manipulated all entrance exam results starting in 2006 or even earlier. That's according to findings released August 7th by lawyers involved in the investigation, confirming recent reports in Japanese media. The school said the manipulation should not have occurred and would not in the future, and it will consider retroactively admitting those who otherwise would have passed the exams, although it did not explain how it would do so. Nearly 50% of Japanese women are college-educated, one of the world's highest levels, but they often face discrimination in the workforce. Women are also considered responsible for homemaking, child-rearing, and elder care, while men are expected to work long hours and outside care services are limited. There's nothing like witnessing a field of fireflies on a stellar summer night. Gone are the days from childhood when capturing fireflies in a jar was a pastime, for me at least. I know, incredibly ecologically incorrect nowadays, I'd never. As I was slipping into slumber on a recent summer night, there was this odd blinking light in the midst. Yep, you know where this is headed. A firefly had made its way into my room. I enjoyed its presence for a few minutes before ushering it outside, so I was quite attracted to the following story, which tells us that if we've noticed more fireflies lighting up our backyards, there's something to this. Veronica Volk brings us the story about the little summer icon.
Whether you call it a lightning bug or a firefly, or perhaps by its scientific name, Lamparidae, chances are you've had some experience with the tiny flying insect that flashes and blinks its way through summer evenings. And as Sarah Lewis notes, astute watchers are noticing even more fireflies this summer than previous years.
You know, a lot of people are enjoying it. I'm thrilled that they're enjoying it. And we're, you know, as firefly scientists, we're just trying to understand it.
Lewis is an evolutionary biologist at Tufts University in Boston. She also wrote a book called Silent Sparks, The Wondrous Life of Fireflies. She says the first thing you have to know about fireflies is that they live underground for 2 years, and they love wet conditions, like those in the spring of 2017.
Those are great conditions for baby fireflies. They're called larvae because they live underground and they feed on earthworms and snails and slugs. And so those wet conditions mean that more larvae are surviving to eventually emerge into adults.
Lewis also explained that despite the surge in population in certain regions this summer, fireflies around the world are in decline. One of the greatest threats is light pollution.
You know that fireflies use bioluminescent signals to find and attract their mates. And when there's a lot of artificial light, it's harder for them to see each other's signals. It's harder for them to find mates.
Some species of fireflies are also victims of habitat loss due to development and climate change. For Great Lakes Today, I'm Veronica Volk in Rochester, New York.
You would not believe your eyes if 10 million fireflies lit up the world as I fell asleep. 'Cause they fill the open air and leave teardrops everywhere. You'd think me rude, but I would just stand and
And that's our show for this week. Thanks to Patrick Garrett for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% archives on our website at wamc.org. This week's show is number 1517.